the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we've talked so often about the privilege that we have as a reserve currency nation. You know, the dollar's been the reserve currency at least since Bretton Woods. But we're seeing news a lot even this week that's making us think, are we going to be a reserve currency much longer?
Well, Kevin, I think it's always worth looking at risks and reanalyzing and relooking at them and reappraising them as we go on. There's a lot happening this week, Kevin, that I think is worth looking at in addition to the stresses and strains in the U.S. market. Because let's just take that as an example. Early this week, we had a downgrade by S&P of U.S. debt put on negative watch. We're AAA status still. But when you get a negative watch, essentially what that means is that over the next 2 years, you have a one-third chance of downgrade, assuming that nothing deteriorates beyond what they think it's going to. So they're projecting decline. They're anticipating. And they're saying we do have real issues here. What's interesting, Kevin, is that when that occurred, you would have expected a sell-off in the Treasury market, and you did not. What we did see was an increase in the dollar and a decline in the euro, because actually trumping the news of our instability here was instability in Europe.
Well, see, that's the thing that we've talked about in the scope of our programs the last few years. The dollar's a reserve currency. It's in big trouble. But actually, where's the competition? I mean, the euro, they've got monetary unification, but they don't have any political unification. So all the southern states can continue to, you know, abuse the system, and the northern states can resent them.
Well, I think, Kevin, this brings a lot of things back into focus. One, you know, for the last 48 hours, I've watched CNBC and Bloomberg, and for the first time in a long time, they're giving attention to balance sheet issues here in the United States. And they're asking, okay, well, if the S&P company says that there's something wrong with U.S. debt, what is it?
Right.
As if this comes as a surprise to them. This, to me, Kevin, shows how far in the sand these ostriches have their heads planted. In the sand, that is. So this is the issue, Kevin. It would appear that this has not been an issue up to this point, and the market should be surprised.
Well, it's a little bit like being surprised that Greece is in trouble or Portugal's in trouble.
Well, and that's exactly what we had with Schauble's statements also this week,
right,
where he said, okay, guess what? We are going to have a debt problem in Greece. And then everyone in Europe is all over him saying, you shouldn't be saying this. This is not true. And he's just stating the obvious, Kevin. He's just stating the obvious. S&P is just stating the obvious. For the first time, you have a company acknowledgement that the king has no clothes in the United States. Schauble, across the pond, is being castigated for just speaking his mind and speaking to the obvious. So, Kevin, essentially what you have is states, whether it is the United States or individual states within Europe, who've spent too much money. Okay, and they don't have enough income to make payments on the debts that they have. This is issue number one. Issue number two, Kevin, is what is the value of these IOUs that they've issued into the market?
Right.
Okay.
And what is their ability to pay?
And here's the real complicating factor, because the ECB, the European Central Bank, cares about keeping stability in the financial markets and specifically in the banking arena. This is the problem. You've got banks in France, you've got banks in Germany, and banks in Italy that are chock full of debt. These are IOUs from Ireland, IOUs from Italy, IOUs from Portugal, IOUs from Greece. And if that debt is diminished in its value, now you're talking about solvency issues within individual banks in these countries.
Well, and David, you've pointed out before, we're talking about Europe right now. Talking about Greece, we think, well, it's just a basket case. But actually, from a debt-to-GDP standpoint, the United States is in worse shape.
Right. We're in no better condition. What we have is a privilege accorded to us by one thing. And you mentioned it earlier, Kevin.
Reserve currency status.
We have reserve currency status. What does it mean to have reserve currency status? What it means is that transactions that happen on an international basis are settled in dollars.
Right.
It means that oil, when it is sold, even if it's between Iran and Italy or between Nigeria and Great Britain, guess what? It's not done in euros, and it's not done in sterling. Those transactions are settled in U.S. dollars.
Well, and it hasn't always been that way, David. I mean, let's face it, just 50 or 60 years ago, it was the sterling. It was the British pound. But let's take a little bit of a look as to how the dollar has risen. I mean, you've talked about 1977 being a very good year for not only the United States, but another basket case country in Portugal. Both 1977 was a good year for both countries.
It was the peak year, Kevin, for us in the United States, wherein as a percentage of international reserves, the dollar made up the largest percentage at that point, 80%
of international reserves.
Of so international
central banks
foreign
that held
reserves.
Reserves, central banks that held reserves, 80% of those reserves, even if they were a country in Europe, was in dollars.
Was in dollars. 1977 was also the best year in 100 years for port in Portugal.
Well, then that hardly counts the same. Now, that's a different kind of reserve.
It was a very good year.
It's a different kind of reserve, and I know you try to keep those reserves. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about dollar supremacy, because we've had dollar supremacy up to this point, but things are starting to look like we're hearing more about the renminbi. We're hearing more about the euro. We're basket of currencies, SDRs. I mean, where are we at on that?
I think the idea that we, being dollar-centric and having a unipolar world focused on the U.S. dollar, that is what's on the table. That's what's in question. But it's not newly on the table. It's been on the table for a long time. I mean, if you look at the obligations that Europe had to the United States following World War II, there was not only a debt of gratitude, but an actual debt. And they were friends and allies of necessity. We were rebuilding Europe.
Right.
I mean, there was a tremendous benefit to them that we had resources and they had none.
Well, we not only had resources, we not only had a dollar that was backed by gold, but we actually had GDP. We had growth in this country. And, you know, Goldman Sachs, this is one more thing that happened this week. Goldman Sachs started at about 3.5% on their estimates for this year for our GDP. They've downgraded it twice, Dave. What's it down to now? I mean,
right, 3.25 to 2.5, and then the most recent was 1.75.
Okay.
When you look at Europe, when you look at Europe and the history of what's happened in Europe, what happened in World War I and World War II was vitally important to the U.S. dollar becoming what it is.
Right.
Okay. Because it wasn't just that we had great innovative minds in America. Certainly we did. And certainly we've seen an improvement in industrial productivity all through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. But what we had was steady growth in the context of Europe taking a major step back.
Sure.
And relatively speaking, we were propelled forward into the number one position. It truly was not simply on the basis of dollar strength, but on the basis of fiscal weakness and monetary weakness elsewhere. So the sterling took a back seat. So the French franc took a back seat. Even the German mark took a back seat to the U.S. dollar. Why? Well, again, replay World War I and World War II, and you see how vitally important these countries, which were bombed out and had to be rebuilt from nothing and did not have the resources to do that, were forced to borrow. And what did they borrow in? They borrowed in dollars.
Yes, but David, that was when we were a creditor country. Now we're a debtor country.
Well, and the progression has been more than just from us moving from creditor to debtor. It's also been a shift in these countries being essentially in abject poverty, taking handouts from the United States and being willing to hawk their future because they had none otherwise,
right,
and do it in dollar terms. And as they've gotten back on their feet, as the engine of growth has been restored within Germany and within Europe, guess what? They've had aspirations to go back to what they had. The French want their franc. The Germans want their Deutschmark. Or, collectively, they wanted and compiled all of their resources together to make the euro.
You know, David, it was fascinating after World War II, just the utter destruction in all the countries that were involved, except for our country, actually. You've got Germany, which, if you've been to Germany, they're still rebuilding after World War II. There's still cranes up where they're rebuilding these old historic buildings. Japan, the same thing. Now, look at the two currencies that became so strong all through, you know, the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and then ultimately allowed a merger for the European Union for the German mark. But the German mark and the Japanese yen actually became the bastions of strength as far as currency goes.
They were, and there's an interesting parallel, Kevin, when you look at the Japanese yen and the story that it had through the 70s and early 80s, it's the same story that's being told of China today.
Mm.
You know, of growth. The engine of growth in Asia, was it China then? No, it was Japan then. And they were invoicing up to 40% invoicing up to 40% of all of their exports in yen terms. This is something that the Chinese are beginning to initiate. They're outpacing our growth here in the United States by three times, Kevin. There's been a replacement in Asia. The yen is impaired. The Japanese economy is impaired. China, relatively speaking, has much more significant year-on-year growth, okay? But they have significant things which they still have to put in place if they want to become a regional currency player or even an international currency player. The question is, can they do those things? Will they accomplish them?
Well, and you wonder about how much time it's going to take. You know, in past conversations with Stephen Rode and other guests that are experts on China, they talk about time being the difficulty because there's a lot of things we see with China. But you and your dad, even last week, sort of disagreed, I have to admit, about how quickly China's going to take over.
And it's a combination of time and favorable circumstances.
Right.
Kevin, if you look at developments of the U.S. financial markets, it was the 1920s where we saw greater issuance of U.S.-denominated debt instruments. Prior to the 1920s, Kevin, we had the U.S. dollar. And yes, we had seen a radical change in terms of industrial growth. And we were exporting even more by 1916 than Great Britain.
Right.
But guess what? Our currency was a domestic, local currency. It wasn't until the 1920s, again, sandwiched between World War I and World War II, where we didn't have competition and we were able to begin marketing U.S. debt, where we began to denominate foreign debt, foreign IOUs, in U.S. dollar terms to a U.S. audience that was investing feverishly.
Well, and there are two key operative words that actually we've recommended for portfolios as well, and one is stability. You can't have a reserve currency without stability. The other is liquidity, the ability to clear international types of transactions very quickly. The dollar's offered that, but we're seeing at this point, David, countries opting not to do that with the dollar. You know, namely the BRIC countries, David, you know, we're talking about Brazil and Russia and India and China. They're starting to talk about trading outside of the dollar amongst themselves just with their own currencies.
Right. So in other words, you're settling transactions and you don't have to convert to dollars first in order to settle those transactions. But if it's a transaction that occurs between South Africa and China, it's going to be settled either in the rand or the renminbi. It's not going to have to go through dollars to be settled, as has been the case for so long. And Kevin, this is one of the things that you just hit on, a very important point. Currency stability is a vital part of this reserve currency status, and it's one of the things that Great Britain began to lose in the 1930s. In the 1930s, Britain provided emergency support to the financial and banking system, and it was at the expense of the pound sterling.
That's when they really lost it, isn't it?
Well, it reinforced a trend of marginalization of the sterling, Kevin, and the exchange rate slipped relative to the dollar from 4.86 to 3.25 in about a year.
Well,
so a one-third depreciation in about a year as the monetary authorities favored the banking system and the financial markets over currency stability. And it was, again, one of those things that added to the handoff of the baton from pound sterling to the U.S. dollar as world's reserve currency.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. That was the 1930s with Britain, but David, that sounds very familiar right now. Oh my gosh. I mean, how much has the dollar declined over the last few years?
Well, we've had about a one-third decline just in the 2000 to 2004 period, and we've been flirting with another support level. If we break 70, Kevin, I'm not sure that we won't give up another 20 or 30% in short order. So we have this, Kevin. It's reminiscent of what the French did. It's reminiscent of what countries throughout time do when they have control of their currencies. This is the great disadvantage of the European countries who have put their stock in the euro. They don't control their currency, and when things get out of balance in terms of their debt, in other words, they have too many liabilities and not enough assets or income to pay those liabilities, then they devalue. The French were serial devaluers through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Kevin, the British were likewise serial devaluers all through this last century. You know, we went from almost a 5-to-1 to the dollar to now about 1.6-to-1 to the dollar, if you're looking at pound sterling. That's been the legacy over the 100-year period. Kevin, we're doing the same thing today, favoring the banking system, favoring the financial system over our currency. And the one thing that has kept investors coming back to the dollar year in, year out, in spite of us having a poor balance sheet, even 20 or 30 years ago, was that there were no alternatives.
Right.
There were no alternatives, and that changed in 1999 with the launch of the euro.
Well, David, let's hit the rewind button just a little bit then. Let's go back to the end of World War II, Bretton Woods, and how it came about. You know, there were no other options, like you said, but there was something that the United States promised the rest of the countries, and that was a solid gold standard.
Well, it was the assumption that the dollar was as good as gold.
Right.
And why was it as good as gold?
Well, it was redeemable in gold, David.
And so it was gold.
Yeah.
I mean, by proxy, the U.S. dollar was gold because if you wanted gold instead of paper script, you could have it. That has not been the case since 1971.
Okay, now what happened in 1971? We know Nixon closed the gold window, but talk about what led up to that.
You had a whole series of things that happened in Europe where they began to grow suspicious of our ability to pay. We were offering to settle these transactions in gold versus paper script, and we still presented ourselves as completely together from a financial standpoint, completely solvent. And yet, the French were looking at our balance sheet saying, I'm not sure that what is being presented is the truth. In other words, it's not the first time, Kevin, that the government here in the United States has fudged the numbers.
Well, you had people who had actually seen it happen to Britain ahead of time. I mean, Jacques Roof is a perfect example, and he was advising Charles de Gaulle at the time in the 1960s.
Exactly. We've talked about this before, Kevin, but he was a young man watching the pound sterling be devalued
right
in the 20s and 30s, and remembered it, and he knew what to look for.
Right.
So there he is in his older years, seeing something similar, something that has a resonance with the past, Kevin, and saying, wow, you know, I think there's a problem with the dollar.
Well, he was a French attaché for France in England at the time that the sterling was losing that power and coming off of the gold standard. He saw the same thing had to happen. In fact, there was a guy named Triffin when he saw that the Bretton Woods Agreement was going to create an unlimited amount of dollars, and there was a limited amount of gold in Fort Knox.
There was a dilemma.
It was called the Triffin Dilemma, and he goes, wait a second, guys. I can't believe it even has a name because it's so obvious. But
right,
the Triffin dilemma is you can't print unlimited money, make it redeemable in gold, if you have a limited amount of gold.
Right. So I guess the importance here is that we're watching the things which structurally have to take place
right
for there to be a euro which has legs into the future, for there to be a renminbi which has legs into the future, for there to be a dollar which has or has not legs into the future. And these things are swirling all around us. So in the daily news, we hear, yes, there's another meeting in the south of China where five countries get together and determine that they're no longer trading in dollars. They're going to work out a trade relationship where they settle transactions directly.
Right. Well, David, we've seen a deterioration in reserves, and we've talked about the countries in Asia wanting to, you know, have other reserves and demanding other types of currencies. We were 80% in 1977, right? 80% of the reserve. Where are we now?
Well, the dollar as a percentage of reserve assets with central banks, those which are reported, has gone from 80% to 66% at the beginning of this decade. Now it's between 60 and 61%. So we're beginning to see a marginal shift.
Right.
There was a pretty radical shift from the 70s, but it, just in this last decade, a marginal shift away from the dollar and towards other currencies. We don't have that true alternative to the dollar. We have the possibility of alternatives to the dollar, Kevin. That's what we think will be exacerbated by what we see in the news today, this week. Kevin, this morning, the central bank governor, Zhu Xiaoshan, said we need to be reducing our exposure to the dollar, and we're going to set up vehicles in order to do that. We're not going to tell you how, we're not going to tell you what we're investing in, but we've determined that we're not at a safe level in terms of our dollar exposure. But Kevin, what that implies is that the central bank of China is not happy with what they own and are not intending to continue to buy treasuries and finance our deficits.
Okay, now speaking of deficit, this is what Standard & Poor's was bringing out on Monday when they talked about downgrading or at least creating a negative impression on, you know, the dollar's future. Paying back our deficits is probably the biggest problem the United States has. And there's a concept that you've talked about with inflation, that we can actually pay back our deficits by just inflating the dollar. Now, that doesn't work when almost all of Americans' money is in dollars. But when it takes 51% of foreigners' money to support the dollar, which is what's happening right now, I mean, it's 51% foreign buying of treasuries, isn't it tempting to start to devalue the dollar in the form of inflation? And would this be why the reserves in these various other countries are starting to be reduced?
Well, Kevin, I think that's on the money. What we have is a subtle form of default. Because we have world reserve currency status, we're not forced to a formal default, but through inflation, we are defaulting on our debt obligations. Now, what's very different, Kevin, if you're looking at monetary history, is classically what you have with these devaluations is a stated devaluation. They'll come out and say, we've just devalued the currency by 14%.
Well, you said the French did it over and over.
Right, so it was 5% or 7% or 6.9% or 14% or 12%, but it was very specific in terms of a stated monetary devaluation. But we've had devaluation, Kevin, here. It's been on a non-stated basis, and I think what is happening is that by understating CPI, by understating the official inflation rate, but running a higher inflation rate, 4 to 6%, or if you're going back to the old models, as much as 10% inflation here in the United States, we are solving our debt issue on the backs of our foreign creditors. Tell me if that doesn't have geopolitical implications. Kevin, just to reiterate, I mean, we've got Moody's, which left Ireland this last week on negative watch and dropped the country's debt rating two notches, just above junk status, Kevin. We've got Portugal, stresses and strains there. We've got Greek debt, Kevin, which is now yielding over 20%, which is a harbinger of collapse.
Right.
You're there in terms of renegotiation, quote unquote, or default, if you prefer just plain language.
That's like reading a sign, we're just about to default, instead of running down the street going, guess what, I just got on my Greek bonds.
A renegotiation. Yeah, language is funny that way, isn't it?
Right.
But Kevin, we've got Europe, which has great potential and major constraints. We've got China, which has great potential and major constraints. We have America, which has great potential and major constraints. I'd love to explore some of these issues, Kevin. Every once in a while, we dip our toe into an academic question and answer. Barry Eichengreen is kind of a tried and true monetary guru. He's been at the University of California, Berkeley for decades and is worth, I think, having a conversation with to entertain some of these issues with.
Well, I think we probably have to ask the question from someone more from an establishment perspective, because let's face it, David, the central banks are establishment. And as they move these directions, the question as to whether the dollar stays the reserve currency, whether we move to a tripolar currency, you know, the euro, the renminbi, the dollar, or SDRs, you have to ask the guys who have actually come up with that stuff. And of course, Barry Eichengreen just wrote a book this year called Exorbitant Privilege, about this very subject.
Kevin, if you were following the Yellow Brick Road and you were going to Oz, once you got there, you'd want to look behind the screen and ask a few of the guys who are wizards, what exactly is happening here? What do you think? What's your perception of reality? Not that it is the reality that we look at, Kevin, and accept, but one that we certainly appreciate from an establishment perspective. Helpful to see the direction of the decision makers the world over.
So for those who'd like to actually hear that conversation and read the book ahead of time, Exorbitant Privilege, we're going to be interviewing Barry Eichengreen next week discussing this very subject. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.